also want to begin with words of Hakaras HaTov, of gratitude. First of all, to Rabbi Eisenberg and the RZC for this partnership and ongoing synergy, so to speak, between our kollel and the Religious Zionists of Chicago. Being a Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion kollel means that Torah Eretz Yisrael is is a very special part of our identity, of who we are, and the chinuch and Torah mandate that we have. And we are grateful, of course, to the Bellows for sponsoring this evening and for their role, not just in the RZC, but of course in our kollel. And I also want to mention and acknowledge with gratitude Yitzi Matanki, who is here, who is responsible for so many of the technical, logistical development aspects of the kollel. So if it wouldn't be for him, I wouldn't be here. I want to focus tonight on a specific area of kind of like a nexus in Jewish life. And it gets to the heart of what it means to be a religious Zionist person. So we could put it both in a historical context, but also in a Torah learning context that will shed some light on how the development of the State of Israel played out, and with a certain respect, but also how it can inform our own lives and how we view ourselves today. And so the topic of tonight's talk is, got a little bit cut off there, I see. It's called Medinat Yisrael via She'ilot U'Tshuvot. She'ilot U'Tshuvot is known in English as responsa literature. And this is a form of Jewish learning that has gone on for centuries, many centuries, whereby rabbis and community members, other rabbis, various inquisitors have exchanged information, exchanged knowledge through, generally, in those days, it was a medium of letters. Today, that medium is somewhat changing a little bit, but traditionally, a she'elah was a letter that was posed to a rabbinic leader, and a tshuva is an answer that was given in response. And this, over the course of time, has grown into a whole corpus of Jewish literature, of halachic learning, and that is the realm of responsa. Now, it happens to be that in different areas of the world and in different historical time periods, the function of she'ilot u'tshuvot shifted. Meaning, you can have just a very transactional, here's my question, here's my answer. That's one kind of she'ilah u'tshuva. You'll find that in various responsa. But you will also find responsa that are kind of just a point of departure for a much longer conversation about this issue. Sometimes you have rabbis who their primary mode of written Torah expression is through she'ilot u'tshuvot, not necessarily commentaries on any particular text. It's actually using the questions and answers as their way of teaching us through the generation. So it's actually an incredibly rich field, the rich field of she'ilot u'tshuvot, shilas and tshuvas, questions and answers, that go back through many centuries. It also, from a historical standpoint, is, I think, an extremely fascinating topic, because it gives you a window into what was going on in that particular time, at that particular place. The types of questions that are being asked, let's say, just by example, the types of questions that are being asked of Sephardic Rabbanim in the 100 years after the Spanish expulsion is different than the questions that are being asked of Ashkenazi rabbis during the period of the Crusades. But there is some similarity. So thinking about the different experiences of the Ashkenazi Jews of that time and the Sephardic Jews, sometimes you can learn about that from the response, from the questions that are being asked, and also, of course, from the answers that are being given from the different rabbis in the different communities. So what I'd like to focus on with you tonight are four questions and answers in a book, a theoretical book that we're going to put together. Each one of you has this book in your hands, and you're, of course, more than welcome to take it with you at home. And that is to think about these four questions and answers in the development of the State of Israel, the settlement of Israel, what Israel means to us as religious Jews. And this is a great way of thinking about it. You talk about religious Zionism. So Zionism means the active role that we play in building the state, the land of Israel. So you're talking already over 100 years pre-state. So we'll start before the state. But as a religious Zionist, it means that everything that we do in this world is framed by and is colored by the glasses of our Torah, of a time-honored divine tradition that goes all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. So it's through a religious perspective that we embrace Zionism. And because so much of our Jewish identity is wrapped up with the process of acting as a Jew, of being a practicing Jew, which is what we call halacha, the path along which we walk, so the path, that path is also going to have to walk along with our lives as Zionists. If we're walking along the path of halacha as religious personalities, so then we're going to walk along that path and meet all kinds of different signposts and crossroads and experiences. One of those is Zionism. So how does building the land look to a halachic personality? What are the kind of questions that are going to be asked, and what are the kind of circumstances we're going to need to deal with in building that reality? So any questions, comments, or observations before we begin? Okay, good. So let's jump right in. I'd like to begin. We're going to talk about four questions and answers that came from four influential rabbinic personalities from our community, from the religious Zionist community. And the place I want to start is Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. And that's the first question that you have on your page. It's actually an answer. You don't have the question printed on your page. But the background is, as some of us are familiar, Rav Cook is a watershed figure in the life of not just religious Jews, but all Jews at the beginning of the 20th century. So right after the turn of the century, he emigrates from Eastern Europe, where he studied the Volozhin Yeshiva, to Yafo, where he becomes the chief rabbi of Yafo, and then he settles in Yerushalayim. Ultimately, in the late 1920s, he establishes a yeshiva called Merkaz Yeshiva Merkazit HaOlamit, the Central Universal Yeshiva. He's a prolific writer. At that point, he's published many, many volumes in different aspects of Jewish thought and Jewish law and Jewish philosophy, and he establishes the chief rabbinate, of which he becomes the first Rav Rashi of Israel. He dies in 1935 in Yerushalayim, Eretz Kodesh. On the right side here, you'll see there's actually an image, a graphic of what some call in the Israeli yeshiva world the Shas Lavan, the white Shas, the white compendium, because for some reason Moshe Rav Cook decided to publish the volumes of Rav Cook. Most of them are in white, so you can see you're talking about a library, a voluminous library of works by Rav Cook in writing, including several volumes of responsa. What you have here, what I'm going to share with you right now, is actually something really incredible. That's Rav Cook. That's actually a real video clip of Rav Cook coming out of the office of Herbert Samuel. That's actually Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, the Rav of the Yeshuv HaYashan. So Rav Cook published a whole group of responsa under different names. But what I wanted to share with you this evening is actually not from Rav Cook's responsa, which one of them is called Ezra's Kohen, Das Kohen, Mishpat Kohen, Orach Mishpat, all of them according to the four sections of the codes of Jewish law. Rav Cook has a different letter that's actually not published in the responsa. It was published in the first volume of Tchumen. Tchumen is a journal that's published annually in Israel. I think it's under Machon Tzomet, if I'm not mistaken. So Tchumen is a very prestigious journal of Hebrew articles spanning all kinds of aspects of Jewish life. Now it's, I think, the 35th year of the Tchumen journal. And in the first one they published, I think what at that time was an unpublished letter from Rav Cook that you have in front of you on your page. So I Xeroxed it for you. And the reason I chose this letter is because it deals with the concept of, and this is not to the exclusion of other Rabbonim and other with other Masorahs, other aspects of Judaism, but it highlights the sensitivity, the issue that Rav Cook was dealing with before the State of Israel was founded, and it's an issue that still goes on today. The question was how to deal with farms on Shabbos, specifically as it relates to milking cows. Remember, at the beginning of the settlement, many of these Jews who came on Aliyah, especially the end of the 19th century, the 1880s, and at the turn of the century, many of them established moshavot, they established farming communities, different settlements in all different kinds of places. A lot of them lived off the land, and one of the major industries of these locations, including kibbutzim, is milking cows. And there is the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos, the 7th parak, that discusses the issue of Malachos of Shabbos, the 39 different categories of work. And later, so that's in the 7th chapter. And later on in the Talmud of Masechus Shabbos, they discuss the question of milking a cow. And you get the impression when you look at the sources closely, which we're not, tonight the purpose is not to go through the issues at hand in these specific responses, because that would take us all night to go through all the primary sources, which would be great and fabulous, but not for tonight. The Gemara says that there is an issue, there is a halachic prohibition against milking a cow on Shabbos. So the rabbis debated, the Rishonim, the early commentators, tried to figure out, well, what is precisely the problem of milking a cow on Shabbos? I don't know. One could suggest that maybe it's a problem of kotzer, harvesting. You're harvesting the milk from the place where it grows. Maybe you could say it's a problem of mamachik. You're smoothing out the udder by the mechanism when you milk a cow with your hand. If you want to know more about this, I would suggest you go to Wagner Farm, where they have a fake cow that you can milk. And if you want to get even more personal, you could probably drive up. The CRC could set you up probably with some farm in Wisconsin. Some people here know Wisconsin very well, and they have a lot of cows, right? That's why it's called the farmer in the Dell. There's cows up there. It's the dairy capital of probably everything. Now they have machines, but I'm sure if you ask, they'll let you. Just you have to ask nicely. So the second possibility is maybe it's kosher. Lots of different opinions on the Rishonim. The most prominent is the sheet of the Balei Tosafos that says that's a problem of schita, of extracting, which is a tolda of dash, which is threshing. So here you have an issue. You have Jews who are on a kibbutz or on a moshav, and they have these cows. The problem is to let them go without milking them on Shabbos, so it's very uncomfortable for the cows. It's a potential question of tzar balei chaim, and it ruins the whole routine. So how do you deal with this? So Rav Kook was asked this in a letter, and Rav Kook, he takes a position in this letter which is stringent. It is not permissive. Rav Kook says that the questioner in this case was none other than Harav Hagon, Marino Harav Ben Sion Chai Uziel. Rav Uziel, who was the chief Sephardic rabbi, writes a letter to Rav Kook. We don't have the original letter in this piece. We just have the response of Rav Kook. Rav Kook says, I received your letter with a Talmudic analysis of the circumstance, which would permit, in some way, Jews to milk these cows on Shabbos. And Rav Kook says, I take exception to that. Rav Kook says, he takes exception to that. He does not agree with that. And he says, we have to come up with some other patent. But as religious Jews, we are bidden to observe what it says in the halacha, and the traditional, the majority opinion in the Rishonim, and the classic commentators of the Shulchan Aruch think it's not a rabbinic restriction, it's a biblical restriction against milking cows on Shabbos. And therefore, Rav Kook says the following. He says, you will find in some farms that there are those who do what's called chaliva le'ibud. They milk the cow, and then the milk just goes into the drain. So Rav Kook writes, he's not so happy about that. But that's a leniency that maybe one could rely on, although he says a rabbinic figure should not proscribe that leniency. Rather, what we need to do is to find non-Jews. You know, especially in those days, Arabs were very common in terms of...
In Europe, didn't they have cows?
So in Europe, it's a very good question how they dealt with this. If you want to talk about how they dealt with non-Jews, I believe Professor Jacob Katz, blessed memory, I think he has a book called Goyishol Shabbat, where he talks a lot about non-Jews and Jews. There's a discussion about this, but you're talking about on a much bigger scale, and this is why this kind of responsum is very important to think about, because Rav Kook is trying to deal with, he's trying to support the farmers. They have to make a living, these guys, and they have to be able to sustain themselves and figure out how to run their farms. But at the same time, as religious Zionists, they have to be able to work within the confines of the halacha. So he says, what you need to do is you need to find a guy, you need to find an Arab to help you milk the cows. Now today, happens to be they came up with different patentum. Now there is something called grumma machines, where they can use a different halachic mechanism, where they can milk the cow through an indirect manner, but that's a different story. The letter that we're sharing right here, Rav Kook has asked, can Jews milk the cows into the garbage and just the milk will go to nothing? And which is a discussion in the world of schita, of squeezing. Rav Kook says the answer is l'chatchila, no. And therefore, he responds that the farmers need to find non-Jews to milk their cows. This letter is dated, you see on the top, Tuf Elul Tuf Resh Pei Vav, 1926. That's letter number one. So on the one hand, he's dealing with the people on the ground out there in these farms. On the other hand, it's not that, you know, you could do whatever you want. We have to be sensitive to an understanding of the contours of the halacha, and there are many different examples in Rav Kook's writing of this. And this is just one tiny example. I want to move on to another very important figure in our community. And this was an Irish great rabbinic genius. Great rabbinic genius. It happens to be, I'll give a quick shout out with your permission, to Rabbi Newman, because last night the Kollel ran our monthly program at the high school for the Skokie Yeshiva High School boys. We have a program that we run there every month. So last night we were talking about, we were talking about Torah Eretz Yisrael. So one of the Rabbeim, Rabbi Yirmiyahu Newman, when he saw the Mar Makomel sheet, which included Divrei Torah from Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, Rav Neria, and Rav Herzog, he's like, oh, my father would love this. So you should know, you got a shout out last night. So one of the people that we talked about last night with the yeshiva boys, with the high school boys, was Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog. Rav Herzog was born in Poland, but his father became a rabbi in northern England as a young man, and he was essentially a child prodigy. He was self-taught. He learned by himself. He became a tremendous gaon, as well as a great scholar. He became, soon after that, he moved to Dublin. He became the chief rabbi of Ireland, and he earned his doctorate. And the doctoral thesis that Rabbi Herzog put out was on the topic of, anybody know? Tchelis, yes. What is the mysterious blue dye? So it happens to be that Rav Herzog, doing various tests, I did identify initially that the tchelis, so not to get too personal here, but this what I'm wearing over here is blue dye. This blue dye comes from a snail that appears in the Mediterranean. It's called the Murex trunculus. The Murex trunculus is a snail that lives on the seabed, and if you squish it open, if you're of that mind, so you'll get a blue dye out of it. Rav Herzog identified the Murex trunculus as opposed to the Radziner Hasidim, who had identified another sea creature as the identification of the Chilazon. Rav Herzog said that was not correct. It was probably the Murex trunculus. The problem was that for Rav Herzog, when he squished the dye out of the Murex trunculus, he got purple. So he abandoned that. He said, it can't be because it's supposed to be blue. Well, the last couple of years, a couple of guys, Ari Greenspan and a few others, they figured out something very unbelievable. It depends. If you squish the dye out of the Murex trunculus indoors, you get it purple. But if you make the dye outside in the sunlight, you get blue. So that was the clincher. And there's a lot more to say about this. But anyway, so Rav Herzog really was right in his understanding of what was tchelis. He just backed off because he couldn't figure it out the last step. But everybody realized that Rav Herzog was correct. So then Rav Herzog moves to Israel, and he becomes extremely active, not just in the world of scholarship, but also in the world of leadership. He spent several months after World War II traveling through Europe. He rescued, I believe, saw at least 600 children from convents and nunneries and all kinds of other homes of non-Jews who had taken in children during the Shoah, whose parents, lo aleinu, where they went. And Rav Herzog went from place to place, fishing them out and finding them, traveling to try to find these holy sparks that were just, they were lost, the children were adopted. So he succeeded in retrieving several hundred children and bringing them to Israel. And then after the, I should have said this earlier, before that, after the passing of Rav Kook, Rav Herzog becomes the chief rabbi, the chief Ashkenazi rabbi after Rav Kook in 1935. He dies in 1959. So these are two pictures of Rav Herzog. This is the Sharblat of Rav Herzog's most well-known collection of responsa, known as Heichal Yitzchak. So this collects really unbelievably amazing letters that Rav Herzog responsa that he wrote to questioners in all different areas, many of them extremely difficult cases, including Aguna and other difficult, difficult issues. And then posthumously, there are about 5 or 6 volumes of Psukim and Ksavim. So one of them you have on your page, on page number 2, a collection of more responsa of Rav Herzog on different topics. The page that you're looking at on page 2 is the third volume. It's Krach Gimel, Shelos Uchuvos B'mitzvos Hatluyos Ba'aretz. What happens when you create a settlement in the land of Israel? And in this context, Rav Herzog's, this letter that you're looking at is in Tuf Shin Yud Gimel, which is 1915, 53. So now we're not only living in the land of Israel, we're living in a state of Israel. All of a sudden, tons of mitzvos, tons of halachos that had been dormant for centuries, all of a sudden become alive. In the last 100+ years, since Jews have been moving en masse back to Eretz Yisrael, there has been a renewed focus because of the need to understand the laws of mitzvos, the commandments that are bound by, that are bound up with the land. We didn't have that before. If you were living in the 15th century or the 16th century, how many Jews were living in Israel? A couple. Then a couple of Kabbalistic Jews moved to Tzfat. Then the Talmidei HaGra'a moved. They moved the Purushim, lived to Yerushalayim. But it wasn't a huge mass of farmers who have to deal with Truma, Maser, Shemitah, Arla, Kilayim, all kinds of halachos, all kinds of areas of Jewish law that have been completely dormant. But now, as religious Zionists, we see the building of the land as a mitzvah in and of itself, a proactive mitzvah that we need to take part in. So now we got to get serious and figure out how to do that. So this question was posed to Rav Herzog. The questioner in this case is Rabbi Adler, or now it's called Nesher, I think, is Harav to Beit Shan. So where is Beit Shan? Anybody know where Beit Shan is? Where?
Lower Galilee.
Lower Galilee, toward, not far from the Kinneret. Which is, imagine, okay, so if Israel is like a banana, starting from the top to the bottom, so it's somewhere over here, like toward the top, for those who can imagine the geography, it's in the valley. And there were quite a few farms in this area, in Beit Shan. And the question came from a specific kibbutz. You see what it says here? Shalom uvracha. Zeh kama zman panu elai mikibbutz ein hanatziv. This kibbutz, still there. You can go online. I did. They have a website. They tell you all about themselves. They tell you where they are and how many families live there and what their industries are. It's a real live kibbutz. It's not. We're not making this up. So in 1953, Kibbutz Ein HaNatziv, I forget the year that it was founded, the reason why it's called Ein HaNatziv, if you want to talk about religious Zionism, is it's named Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the last Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhin Yeshiva in Europe. He died in, I don't know, the 1880-something. He closed the yeshiva in the late 1880s. So the Netziv was the teacher of Rav Kook, as well as, you know, of many other students of Volozhin. He was a great Gaon, a great Talmudic giant, authored also a commentary on the Chumash called HaMikdavar, commentary on the She'ultas of Rav Achoy Gaon, as well as his own responsa called Meshiv Davar. So this kibbutz is named after the Netziv. So what kind of a kibbutz is it? If you think you're naming your kibbutz after the Netziv, yeah, it's a Dati kibbutz. It's not some kind of, you know, Shomer HaTzair guys who are naming themselves after the Netziv. This is a real Dati kibbutz. So they have a Shaila. They're religious Zionists, so they have a question. They're getting their kibbutz off the ground, they're planting their trees, and they got to figure out, wait a second, the Pasuk says there is a halacha that the first 3 years are restricted. What are they called? Orla. You may not use them, you may not eat them, you may not sell them. So what do you do? So they have an interesting question. They say, wait a second, we're located in Beit Shan. Beit Shan is a place which is already discussed in Mishnaic times, and they wonder, in Aleph, you don't know the question, but you, like many things in response to literature, you learn about the question from the answer. Etzem hadavar she'ein hanatziv lo me'eretz Yisrael lo baruli. What? Ein HaNatziv is not from Eretz Yisrael. So two things. Number one, look how in the brackets Rav Herzog writes, in the Aleph on the right-hand column, in the brackets he writes, Lafi HaHalacha. According to the Halacha. So obviously, Beit Shan and Ein HaNatziv are part of Eretz Yisrael, the geographic Eretz Yisrael. However, the Mishnayos describe how when Ezra went up on the Aliyah Shniyah, to be Mekadesh, the portions of the land, there were some parts of the land that he left without Kedushas Eretz Yisrael. Why would he do that? So the Gemara says something interesting. Because we know that every 7 years, there is a very strange thing that happens to the economy. It's called Shemitah. And if you're an agrarian society, it's going to hit even harder. And who gets most affected when there's an economic downturn? It's not the rich people, it's the poor people. So the Gemara says one of the cheshbonos that Ezra had was so that people could still work the land in Shemitah and make sure that the poor people could eat something for dinner at night. So there were portions of Eretz Yisrael that were not niskaju, they were not sanctified by design. So Ein HaNetziv, based on the analysis that they have a discussion about Beit Shan and other Makoros, they wonder, well, maybe we're not part of Eretz Yisrael. And if we're not part of Eretz Yisrael, from a halachic perspective, maybe we're not subject to the laws of Orla. So Rav Herzog responds to them. He says, number one, first of all, he says, it's not so clear to me. He quotes a Dr. Breuer. I don't know which Dr. Breuer this is, if this is Dr. Yitzchak Breuer or a different Dr. Breuer. He says, I'm not 100% sure. You have to be very confident to know whether the specific location that you're dealing with is really not part of Eretz Yisrael. Go find a map from 2,000 years ago. It's very difficult to ascertain that. The second thing he says is that's not necessarily going to help you, which is actually a relevant question here in America about certain fruits. I will tell you, if you go to the Chicago, what's it called? The Garfield Park Conservatory. Place is Gavaldic. Gavaldic. You can learn a ton about Hilchos Brachos from that place. I went with Nechama. We went last year. The poor guy, I couldn't help myself, because the poor guy there who was talking to us, I was talking to Bechainik about the banana plants and the pineapple plants and what the blessing is, because he was explaining to me how I could see how the banana plant grows and how the pineapple plant grows and how there's a big shiloh about papayas with this question about Orla. Rav Avadia has a tshuva about this. I didn't tell him about the tshuva of Rav Avadia because that probably would have scared him off. But as it was, if you want to learn about plants and fruits here in Chicago, that's the place to go, even in the wintertime, because it's all covered by glass. But anyway, coming back here, so the din is that Orla does apply in Chutz La'aretz. So Rav Herzog says to them, look, it's not going to help you much. Even if you were to tell me that Ein HaNetziv is Chutz La'aretz, it's not Eretz Yisrael, Orla still applies outside of Israel. So if a person in this room has some way of keeping a plant, a fruit-bearing plant, alive in this Arctic tundra of winter, so if you can keep it going, I don't know if you have
apple trees.
You have an apple tree.
Pear trees.
Pear trees.
They're all around.
Yeah, I don't know how that works. I feel like they have winter coats or something. I don't know. But however you keep those things going, if you had one for the first 3 years, you wouldn't be able to eat the fruit. That's also halacha l'moshe misinai. Orla in Chutz La'aretz halacha l'moshe misinai. Now, you might say to me, wait, I'm going to go to the grocery store. I don't know if it's orla or not. Just one second. There is also part of the halacha l'moshe misinai is that safek orla in Chutz La'aretz is mutter. If you're not sure, if it's not your tree, safek orla in Chutz La'aretz is mutter. So therefore, it's less of a tension here to people to go. That's why it's not so popular to hear about it. A, because most often the fruits in the first 3 years, they're not as good quality, so they may not make it to the market. And even if they were, it's a safek orla in Chutz La'aretz. Yes, I apologize for keeping you waiting.
It wasn't just Ein HaNetziv, it was Tirat Zvi, which was just even older than later on was Delia, all the three kibbutzim. So it doesn't apply only to Ein HaNetziv, but to Tirat Zvi, it's daily.
That applies to all the places. It happens to be, you're mentioning the names of other religious moshavim, Tirat Zvi.
They were older than Ein HaNetziv.
Right.
Tirat Zvi was older
right.
than Ein
HaNetziv.
They're called the Mishulash, in fact.
Why, they happens to be, this Shaila came from Ein HaNetziv, but I assume it would apply to all of them. Why is it called Tirat Zvi? After Rav Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, the author, the great religious Zionist rabbinic figure from the 19th century, Rav Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. So that's why they called these religious, I don't know why Stei Eliyahu is called Stei Eliyahu, that I don't know, you have to find out. I don't know the answer to that. It's probably easily found out. Somebody probably Googled it already under the table. Okay, so then Rav Herzog writes, even if you're living in Chutz La'aretz, you still have the problem of Orla. So what do you do? So we look in Ozdal, Lefichach, Ein Ani Roeh Lefnehem, Lefnechem derech acheret. I don't know of any other way to get around this problem of Orla except what it says in Yordea Simen Reish Tzadi Dalet 294 Sif Tezvav Vitzarech Lamaher Bezeh. So again, Rav Herzog, on the one hand, dealing with a real life situation of an economic question. Here you have a farm. They're planting. Agriculture is super important, especially in those days. And at the same time, he says the bottom line is, you know what to do. Look in the Shulchan Aruch. That's what you got to do. And the Shulchan Aruch there says, you know what you need to do? You need to create a partnership with a goy, and then you can work it out that you can sell the goy the trees, and then the goy can harvest it, and he can sell it, and you can work it out some way. So this is another example of something that 300 years ago, it wouldn't have been as common. But now, as part of the rebirth of the settlement of the land of Israel, we are seeing it playing out in Befo'el. So let's move along. Any questions, comments, or observations? In Kibbutz Lavi, they don't what?
They don't duchen
because it's outside of Eretz Yisrael. So that's interesting. It's interesting that the question of duchening is a function of that. This same question comes up. Okay, let's move on to another late great rabbinic figure from our community, and that is Rav Shlomo Goren. Rav Goren was born in 1917 in Zambrów in Poland, and in 1925 he came to Eretz Yisrael, where his father was one of the founders of Kfar Hasidim, and he entered the Chevron Yeshiva. Chevron Yeshiva Knesset Yisrael still exists today. Rav Goren was a prodigious Talmud Chacham, a tremendous genius. He wrote many works, Torah Samoadim, Torah Sahalacha, like a whole bunch, in addition to several volumes of tshuvas called Meshiv Molchama, which we're going to look at right now. I like this picture at the top. It's a dashing individual. Also a brilliant Torah genius, as well as a member of the Israel Defense Force. Well, he was the chief rabbi, exactly. He wasn't an artillery man. He was the chief rabbi, the chief rabbi of the IDF, and then he became, alongside Rav Avad Yosef, Zichrono Livracha, they were chief rabbis at the same time of the State of Israel. So Rav Goren, as the chief rabbi, was introduced to a whole new set of halachic questions. Here again, you don't have this if you're living in Shmodzegrodzegrod in the 17th century, being killed by the Russians and the Poles and whoever else is killing you all the time in the diaspora. Now you have your own army. Well, that's complicated. It's very complicated. On the one hand, we're Zionists, we're going to build this army. On the other hand, we're religious. So we've got to figure out how it operates in the realm of halacha. So I'm sharing with you here one question, and I'm about to do something that's a crime. So let's be mindful of this. I did something terrible, but I had to do it for the purpose just of this year and of time. On this page, you have the beginning of the question, and then the end of the question. And I took out the 15 pages in the middle. Now, I went through the whole tshuva, and if you would like, I could scan them and email them to you, all 15 pages of it. But for the purpose of what we have tonight, we're just going to do the question and then the summary. All right? Mrs. Buckman is nodding. That's good for you. All right. So let's, fascinating question that Rav Goren is dealing with. Right here. This is in the third volume of Meshiv Molchama. It's Simen Yud Beis. This is the first volume of Meshiv Molchama. Chelek Aleph, Simen Yud Beis. Anachnu hachayalim datiyim. Here's the question. Rav Goren writes the question. We are religious soldiers. Anshei tzeves karka bechel ha'avir. We are the ground support staff of the Air Force. He doesn't tell you the date. We're the Air Force ground staff. We ask you the following halakhic question. Haim mutar lanu, are we permitted levatzea b'shabbos avodos b'matusim hanimtzaim b'matzav shel konanut o konanut bitchonit o konanut l'chipus v'hatzala? Are we allowed to do avodot, what does that mean? Work, meaning mechanical work on airplanes. We're airplane mechanics. Can we do our work on Shabbos for planes, Israel Air Force planes, in their state of readiness? Konanut means readiness. Are you prepared? O konanut bitchonit, or security readiness, or chipus vahatzala. What's chipus vahatzala? Search and rescue. So we're mechanics, we're machinists. Can we do work on the airplanes on Shabbos? We are expected, according to the regulations of the army. Now, we know that the state and the army don't themselves inherently operate according to the halacha, so they're coming to Rav Goren to give them the halachic advice, because on the books it says you have to do inspections. When do they do machinist inspections? Yom Yomis, that means every day. Bedika lefnei hatisa hakoleles. And what does it include? What does it mean that we're going to have to do a pre-flight check on every plane every day? So he tells you, haf'olas machshire chashmal shonim, turning on various electric components. Kamokain haf'olas ha, second line, last word on the line. Generator. That's not original Hebrew. Generator. Kedei levadei shimusho, to make sure that it works. Lehisna'as, lahasno'as hamatos, to get the motor going. Bilado yefshal hasniat hamatos. Hashilanu gaz gam, last line, also important. Lachasima besefer hamatos al bitzua habdigos b'shabbos. Bilada hatayas hayamim. Can they sign off on the checks? Can they sign off to say we did the check of this particular aircraft? Because if we don't sign on it, the pilot won't be able to fly because he won't have the confidence, he won't have the issuer legally, he won't have the proper authorization. So on the one hand, we're not in the middle of a war, so you could tell me maybe it's not pikuach nefesh. Is it a life-saving immediate institution? No. On the other hand, if you have planes that are not ready, so how are you going to take off? Let's say there is something dramatic that happens. Let's say in the middle, God forbid, of Yom Kippur. And all your planes are not in a state of readiness because everybody's busy clapping al chait in the middle of shul. Nobody checked the planes. So what's the din? So what does Rav Goren do? So first Rav Goren breaks this question down into a couple of different components. And he analyzes it from a strictly halachic standpoint. Where does any good discussion of a halachic topic begin? It always begins in the Talmud. Sometimes it begins earlier in the Chumash, but the Talmud is the vast repository of rabbinic knowledge from which we can draw. So Rav Goren picks up on a Gemara, a Tosefta, a rabbinic text from the Mishnaic period. We still have a few more minutes. I'm mindful of the time. In Maseches Eruvin, where the Gemara has a discussion in the old days when Jews had to protect themselves in their various communities in Israel, different places. So they would go, they were Yotz and Lahatzel, they would take their swords and spears out to war. But the problem is when they would go out to war, they had to carry them back. Well, there's no Eruv. So how do you carry it back? So first the Gemara says they used to leave them in a house outside the city, just their first location. Then the Gemara says there was some kind of catastrophe that they were attacked and they had to go get it. It was a big balagan. People were killing each other. So the Gemara says, we made a takana. Everybody can bring your weapons home. Interesting. Why are you bringing your weapons home?
They might need it again.
You might need it again. So Rav Goren develops a whole discussion of halakhic analysis based on the comments of Rabbeinu Yohanan, which is a commentary on the riff in the back of the Chas, in the back of the Talmud, to discuss this question, and he proves from this piece of Talmud, even though the Rambam doesn't concur with this analysis, the many Rishonim agree with the simple understanding of the Gemara, that you see from there that you have to have your equipment ready. You have to have it at home. It's got to be ready. So even though it's not actual pikuach nefesh, it's not a life-saving activity right now to take your equipment home with you and to violate Shabbos by carrying it in Rishis Rabbim, nonetheless, part of a takana, the rabbinic enactment, was that you should be able to do that so that the next time you'll be at the ready. So Rav Goren begins with this Gemara and develops it at length to prove his point that, wait a second, you can't say, well, since the airplanes are not needed right this minute, it's not pikuach nefesh, you don't have to get them ready. Yes, you do have to get them ready. On the other hand, that doesn't mean it's a blank open door to do whatever you need. First is, wait a second, is it possible? What if you do the checks right Friday afternoon? Can that carry you till Motzei Shabbos? So that's a question. Maybe there's a difference between the maintenance that needs to be done right in the morning before flight and not. Furthermore, and we'll see this now inside. Number one, he said, and I put you just down on maskanot, the bottom, maskanos, the conclusion. Number four, furthermore, he says, maybe you can have other planes that are already at the ready and you don't need to do the work on this plane. So first one, he says, number one, any plane that needs to be at the ready according to the regulations and that the flight cannot take place without this check, then it is permitted to be done on Shabbos if there's no other way. So that's why in base, he says, if you could do it on Friday, because, hey, better do it on Friday. But if you can't do it on Friday, then do it on Shabbos. And that's what he points out in Gimel, that there are different kinds of activities. Kol shein mufalos al-yedei zerem yashar me'hamatzberim. Matzberim are batteries. There's a difference between batteries and generators, and I'm not going to get into all the details here. Between electrical activities, which is derabbanan, and biblical, that's not so, you know, you could take a look at it on your own time. But what Rav Goren is navigating here is a classic religious Zionist question in the context of the tzava, of the army. Thinking about, on the one hand, the security needs and what constitutes pikuach nefesh and what's essential. And at the same time, on the other hand, figuring out, according to the halacha, what is acceptable. So he has to prioritize what you may or may not do. The last line he said, which is very interesting, he says, you may not sign the log. You may not. He says, you know what you need to do? You need to come up with some better mechanism. Because signing the log doesn't make the airplane any more or less ready. It's just a technical thing to make sure that the, so you know what maybe you need to do? Maybe you need to find, and I'm speaking not Rav Goren, maybe take a paper clip, maybe fold the paper, maybe come up with some other mechanism where you don't have to violate Shabbos, because if you have to write on Shabbos, that's an Issur D'oraisa. Today, they've come up with a new idea, something called disappearing ink, which lowers the threshold. So now, that this is actually used in some places. Sometimes people, doctors use it on Shabbos, so that it's not a malacha d'oraisa. But Rav Goren here is navigating, on the one hand, we need to do what is necessary for pikuach nefesh based on the Gemara. It's not, he just didn't make it up. It's based on the Gemara and the analysis that we've shown him. But at the same time, there are limits in terms of understanding what's necessary and what's not necessary from a halachic perspective. Last question that we're going to deal with, and let's move along to the last rabbinic figure we're going to meet. And this is somebody who's not, I think, not as generally well known in the community. Also a very important figure, and his name was Rav Chaim David Halevi. He was born in 1924 in Yerushalayim, and he studied in Porat Yosef. I dafka wanted to especially have someone who is Sephardic, because that's a very significant part of our tradition. And for many years, I'll tell you exactly how long, from 1974 until 1977, he served as the chief rabbi and the head of the rabbinical court of Tel Aviv and Yafo. And he passed away not long ago. He passed away in 1998. So Rav Chaim David Halevi wrote a series of volumes of tshuvas, which you're looking at here. I have the volume that we're going to look at right now. It's called Aseh Lecha Rav. These are very beautiful responsa. They're very different than, let's say, the responsa of, I don't know, certainly from 18th century Lithuanian or Polish or Czechoslovakian rabbinic authors. This responsa, as you can see, I'll show you, they're generally brief. They're not too packed with sources. They're kind of simple and straightforward in their style. And he has quite a few volumes. They cover a whole variety of topics. So here is a fascinating she'ela that came to Rav Chaim David Halevi, this great Sephardic luminary. And it's published in the first volume of Aseh Lecha Rav, Simen Yud Gimel. The question is the following. Ha'efshar levatel esom ha'tishabav b'yamenu acharei hakamas medinas Yisrael. Now that we've established the state of Israel, maybe we no longer need to observe Tisha B'Av. And he begins the she'ela. Now we have Tkumas Yisrael, and after Shichrur Yerushalayim, so perhaps there is no longer a requirement to observe Tisha B'Av. And Rav Chaim David Halevi's response is, great question. You're not the first to ask that question. You know who asked that question before you? The Navi Zechariah. The Navi Zechariah, in, you'll see, he's on the right-hand side, he cites a whole group of psukim from Perek Zayin and Perek Ches from the prophet Zechariah, who lived at the time of the beginning of the Second Temple period, was asked, on the fourth year of Daryavish HaMelech, he was asked, Ha'evkeh b'chodesh ha'chamishi, should I still mourn during Chodesh HaChamishi? What is the fifth month? Av. The second Beis HaMikdash had been rebuilt. And we wanted to know, do we still observe Tisha B'Av? So he says, it's a great question. So he goes through the verses in the Psukim in Zechariah, where the Navi describes Tzom HaRevi'i, Tzom HaChamishi. Tzom HaRevi'i is the 17th of Tammuz, the fourth month. Tzom HaChamishi, the fifth month, is Tisha B'Av. Tzom HaShvi'i is Tzom Gedalia. And the fourth one, Tzom HaAsiri, Asar B'Tevesh, Tevesh Yula Beis Yula Sosn LaSimcha. Good news, rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, as it says, B'Yom Yusad Beis Hashem Tzvakos HaEchal Lehibanos. After the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, we don't observe this Tzom anymore. So the end of the conclusion of this tshuva is that, are we going to observe Tisha B'Av today? Yes. Why? Because we don't have the Beis HaMikdash. But in the context of the tshuva, he has a beautiful, beautiful insight. It's a great way to conclude the shiur. He quotes the beginning of the Pesukim, where the Navi and Zachari describes, wait a second, what is the point of the fast in the first place? God doesn't need you to go hungry. It doesn't benefit him in any way. What's the whole idea? The whole idea is to really help us focus and create meaning, create something that we're going to remember. That's the purpose of the fast. That's why I'm looking on the second column where the words start, Vaharayon, the second paragraph. Hatzom einu l'chvoro shel Hashem, v'af lo ma'anyeno, im yodas ha'uma lizkor yomei churba v'osona, v'kovas osom yomot zom v'tfila, chazaka ala ki gam tiska v'geula. He darshes the Pesukim to say, you know why we have to fast on the past? Because if we remember the tragedies of the past, we will merit to also live in the future, to see the Geula in the future. It relates to the timelessness of our people. So on the one hand, there's the halachic question of, do we observe Tisha B'Av? The answer is yes. But there's the hashkafic and almost philosophical perspective of the fast, which is we observe Tisha B'Av because it's part of a process. That the more we recognize what we lost and we think about what we miss, we can long for it and aim for it as we build toward the future. So he says, yes, Adaraba, now when we've conquered Harabayas, and yet we can't get there, we can't go there because of all kinds of halakha considerations and other considerations, it should make us even more focused in our Tisha B'Av, to be focused on that last step that we're looking for to complete the Geula, even though, yes, as he begins with, and this is certainly part of our tradition in this community, of Reishis Smichas Geula Seinu, we're in the process of the redemption, but it's not 100% there yet. So to summarize, we had the chance this evening, to give a little bit of a surview of four different questions posed to four different great religious figures, great Gaonim, great Gedolei Torah, Medinas Yisrael via Shilas and Tshuva. So the first was Rav Kook and the second was Rav Herzog, both dealing with agricultural questions in terms of the setting up of the land. Rav Kook was dealing with milking the cows, Rav Herzog was dealing with the fruit that was growing that was Orla, beginning before the state and then during the state, then moving to the question, one of the many, many questions that Goren deals with in three volumes of Meisha Melchama about the army in terms of preparedness for the mechanics in the Air Force on Shabbos. And then the last question, which is more of a meta question, both in terms of the scope of the question, in terms of Tisha B'Av, it's a huge issue, it's a halachic question, but also in terms of the hashkafa, the outlook of the process. So on the one hand, yes, we are in the process of Geula. On the other hand, it's not a full Geula, and therefore we still observe Tisha B'Av. And the lack of the full Geula, it should sensitize us to being, on the one hand, recognizing that we're on the way, but on the other hand, we're not there yet. So when we observe Tisha B'Av, we should be more appreciative of what we have and also more longing for that little bit that we need, the Geula Shleima that should come from the hair of Yameinu. Amen. Amen. Thank you all for coming. It's an honor and a pleasure.